Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Jeremy Goodwin, and you're hearing just a little bit of Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony by St. Louis Symphony Orchestra under the baton of my next guest. Leonard Slatkin has been associated with St. Louis Symphony for more than 50 years, 17 of them as its music director. He will lead the SLSO this weekend in two performances of Slatkin's Legacy, a birthday celebration. The program has a family feel, with the U.S. premiere of a piece by Daniel Slatkin, that's Leonard's son, and a work by the American composer Cindy McTee, who happens to be married to Leonard. Joining me now in the studio to talk about all of this is St. Louis Symphony Conductor Laureate Leonard Slatkin. Leonard, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back.
So your 80th birthday was September 1st, but I suppose the holding off on the party until this weekend.
Actually, the party, I suspect, is going to go on for the majority of the season since I'm visiting primarily orchestras where I have close associations and ties, where I was either music director or that I visit almost annually. But this is clearly the high point simply because it's home.
So at the time of thinking about your career, of thinking about your life, when you think about your time in St. Louis, what are you most proud of?
Usually people have trouble answering a question like that, but I don't. And it's because it goes to what is to me the most valuable part of anybody's contribution, and that's education. So in 1969, the second year I was here as the assistant conductor, I was fortunate enough to have great support to found the Youth Orchestra. There wasn't one, surprisingly, in a city like St. Louis, which has enough people to support an organization like that. So we spent a lot of time figuring out how we were going to do it, the best way to handle auditions, how to gently bring those young people who didn't make the orchestra down so they could consider continuing their musical education in schools. The simple fact is that the Youth Orchestra has survived all the years and continues to flourish and is doing so well. I guess a legacy, if one calls it that, is not always measured by what you leave behind, but what you have perhaps founded that continues after you're gone.
Mm. Is there anything that you left undone?
There always is if you're in music, simply because you strive to get better through each performance, for each rehearsal. I would say there are things that I didn't do in my own career musically that maybe I would have liked to if it had gone a different direction. It's interesting that I had posts in Europe in the later part of my orchestral career rather than the early one. But I determined early on that what I wanted to do was be a true American music director, somebody who was born here, who studied here, and who made their career in the States. So Europe came a little bit later. However, between my stints at the BBC and then with Orchestre National de Lyon, I found myself absolutely in love with the European systems and way of working and making music. So at least for a while, I was able to balance the two. And now I just go back as a guest, and it's always great fun. But once in a while, I wonder what would have happened if, say, Lyon had come about 35, 40 years ago. Would I have moved to Europe? I'm not sure. But I'm content with what I did.
You came to St. Louis in 1968. 11 years later, you became the music director here. How has the organization or the orchestra changed since then?
Well, obviously, there are very few people left from 1968. In fact, maybe none.
But well, beyond the personnel.
Well, the whole musical scene has changed, not just for St. Louis, but the entire orchestral world. We didn't have performances of music with films, for example. Didn't exist back in 68. We had less variety of repertoire simply because, well, we have a lot of years between 1968 and now. So that's 50 more years of music that was created and that needs to be explored and find out. So the simple history of the sheer amount of music that came afterwards makes that job more difficult. And sadly, again, not just nationwide, but worldwide, we have a declining set of educational values when it comes to educating our young people, not just in music, but in the arts in general. So we have to find ways to get information in an entertaining way, probably by use of the various new technologies that exist. We didn't have computers. We didn't have anything like that. If you wanted a ticket, maybe you called up to get one. Maybe you actually came down to the box office, looked at the seating chart, and got the seats. The orchestra itself is probably close to the same size it was in 1968 and probably populated by more young people. The turnover
on stage?
On stage. The older days, musicians didn't go back and forth between orchestras. So in any given season, we very rarely had more than two vacancies a year. Now it's going to go into the sevens to tens, even up to 15. A couple of orchestras had up to 30 vacancies in one season, just because, one, COVID called that out. A lot of people retired early. Many people decided they didn't want to be in music anymore. Lots of things happened. So the whole scene in the world is changing. Also, I think another thing that's more valuable now than it was when I started is the level of involvement in the community that both the musicians and the staff have. They have to be more connected to all the areas of the city. They have to be concerned about the diversity issues that are important now in our time and were important back then, but we didn't see them that way and we didn't address them. Now they're being looked at, and that's highly important for a city, especially like St. Louis. It'll be interesting to see what happens when the orchestra returns to Powell Hall. Certainly there'll be a lot of excitement, and I suspect the public will be anxious to experience the new vision of Powell. The question is, will it be able to attract new audiences, either through programming, through initiatives, however they decide to do it? So that's all different than it was back in 68.
Well, one of your early big breaks when you weren't yet the SLSO music director was leading the orchestra's recordings of the orchestral works of George Gershwin back in 1974. What was the impact of those recordings on your career and also the SLSO?
One thing that was really critical was that when I started as the assistant, the management and the music director, then Walter Siskin, the executive director was Peter Pastrak, really tried to begin to broaden the reach of the orchestra. A deal was put together between Vox Recordings and the St. Louis Symphony. Vox had also, I think, engaged Cincinnati and the Minnesota Orchestra to do recordings. They wanted to make a splash the first time out. And the idea of Gershwin came to my head, but originally I thought it's just an idea for the orchestra for its music director to do, Walter Siskind. And he in turn said, nope, that's a project for me to do. It's very rare for the music director to turn over a big project like this as the first venture out into recording to the assistant conductor. So, of course, it was huge. The album was acclaimed all over the world. It's sold very well, never went out of print. It's been reissued now in wonderful sound, so one wonders why you have to make a recording again. I would say that was one of the major factors for me in my career. The year it came out was also the year I made my debuts at the New York Philharmonic, the Chicago Symphony, the Royal Philharmonic in London. So 1974 was the transitional year to me.
And when you recorded that, at the time it was three LPs stuffed with music.
Yep.
You had limited time in the studio to get it all down.
Very little. And back then, there was no recording from concerts as there is now. Today, you record the concerts, maybe you play it twice, sometimes three times. Then you spend a half hour, an hour fixing up the notes that weren't right, things that weren't together, the audience noise. But back then, we would do the concerts or sight read, one of the two. Then we'd come into the hall and just record. We didn't have a lot of time.
By the time you got to those last few pieces in the Gershwin Orchestral Catalog, we're talking about one take at a time?
That's right. The Promenade, we just sight read it, and that was it. It's one take because that's all we had time to do. And
Promenade?
It was absolutely incredible. George Silfies was a genius. I mean, we all just went and hugged him right after we did that take.
Well, we have a recording of that. So why don't we take a listen? We'll be right back. When you hear that recording from 1974, what's going through your head right now?
How did we do that? Not a word was spoken. We'd not seen this piece. We'd never rehearsed it. We just played it, and everybody got in the groove. I guess maybe they heard the first 8 bars and said, yeah, we know how this goes. Of course, by this time, after 5 years of working with me, and we played Gershwin pretty regularly in the concerts that I was doing, we had the style down. We had it very comfortably in hand, so it really wasn't a problem. And we had these great stars in the orchestra already, well before I came as music director.
And so your sight reading for that performance, this ended up becoming a popular encore number for you, right?
Yeah,
this,
we took it on tour.
Around.
We took it everywhere. We took it in the States tour, took it to Japan, took it to Europe, and people loved it. It comes from a film, and the sequence in the film is called Walking the Dog. It's on the ship promenade, and Fred Astaire and company are all there with their puppies, and they're dancing, and it's great.
I could almost hear Fred Astaire in that recording.
Yes. Well, that's the idea.
In a sense.
Except the problem today is, if I look at an orchestra and I'm rehearsing American in Paris or whatever, I say, if you would just imagine Fred Astaire, that's how it has to sound. And then you look at the orchestra and you realize 7/8 of them have no idea who I'm talking about. Well,
different reference needed.
Different one, but I can't think of what it would be.
Well, you have won 6 Grammys, mm-hmm. 2 of them for work with St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. You've been nominated 35 times. Who's counting? Did you have a sense after that first session that you would be such a prolific recording artist?
No, because I was just the assistant conductor, and I thought it was a one-off. I thought, that's great, I'll make that, and we'll see what happens in the future. But I just went back to my role of making sure I was around for every rehearsal and concert in case something happened to the conductors. I think I did a couple more as the assistant. There was one album that I shared with Walter Siskind of Russian music, Slavic music. And then when I became music director, Vox stayed on board, and we started recording a lot of Russian repertoire. We did the complete works of Rachmaninoff. That was 10 LPs back then.
And recording became a focus in St. Louis more than it had been before, right?
Well, St. Louis was on the recording map during the years of Vladimir Goldschmidt for Capitol Records. They made many, many discs. Then there were sporadic ones. Leonard Bernstein made his first recording with an orchestra here in St. Louis of his Jeremiah Symphony. Andre Previn made his first orchestra recording here in St. Louis. But this was not normal. But in the late 60s and into the 70s, 80s, all of a sudden, there was something called the media guarantee clause in a contract, which actually meant that the musicians didn't get paid anything extra for making recordings. It was part of the contract. So eventually we were doing 5 and 6 discs a year. And if you couple that with later on the European ones I made, I would have like a recording a month come out. It was crazy. But it was wonderful. I could record almost everything I wanted to do. So I accounted for a lot of American music, all the Russian music we did, and eventually would be French and English music to add to that as well.
Well, one of the pieces in this weekend's concerts is Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. Mm-hmm. That's something you recorded with St. Louis Symphony and also took on tour.
Yep.
Let's listen to a little bit of the first movement here from your 2007 recording. So this piece is the one sort of greatest hit from the repertory that is in the concerts this weekend. Why is this special to you?
The Russian heritage in my family is very strong. My mother's family was from Belarus. My father's family from Ukraine. My father's family settled here in St. Louis. And my mother's family, they went to New York. But they were all musicians. So growing up in a household filled with music, in particular Russian music, was important to me. By the time I became the music director here in St. Louis, the orchestral scene in the United States had changed. No longer was it Ormandy in Philadelphia, so forth and so on, Koussevitzky in Boston. No, it had moved, and we were seeing more Austro-Germanic repertoire come in, more Mahler, more Bruckner, more Strauss, lots of Beethoven, lots of Schubert. So the Russian repertoire was not disappearing, but not as prominent. And I thought it would be a good idea if we could have representation on recording in the American repertoire, both old pieces and new ones, as well as the Russian repertoire, which was, for me, second nature. We played a lot of it, especially this piece, the fifth, Tchaikovsky, and the second Rachmaninoff symphonies. Those became signature works for the orchestra on tours. They were eventually very much like the Gershwin we heard earlier. They became ingrained in the style. They knew how I wanted to do the music. I knew how they wanted to play it. We were easily comfortable with almost all the composers from these times.
And as we heard, the symphony begins with a lot of introspection,
dark,
moodiness.
Very dark.
It builds to a big, brassy finale. Is it a tricky piece to record?
Every piece is a tricky piece to record because you think for a moment, okay, is this how I want to be represented? And then once you start recording, you don't care about that anymore. You just go, let's make this as close to a performance as we can. But there's a big difference between the live performance and the recording. When you do the recording, you draw on the experience that you have of having played the work usually two or three times in concerts, and you record it usually somewhere in that time frame. So everybody's comfortable with it. But you want to go past the comfort level. You want to bring it to something that literally explodes off of the disc, that makes people want to hear it a second time. I personally usually don't listen to something once it's released. It's part of history, a little bit representing a particular time. And interpretation and ideas change and they move ahead. I wound up doing another Tchaikovsky cycle with the Detroit Symphony. But I can't tell you if it's very much different than the St. Louis Symphony cycle just because I move on. I don't think about it. And this performance that we'll do this weekend of the Tchaikovsky Five will hopefully be different than either the two recordings I made of it or any other performance I've ever given of it.
And there's a moment late in the going where an audience member might be moved to jump to their feet and start applauding several minutes early.
Correct.
Let's listen to the build-up to that moment, again, from your recording. How do you deal with that moment in the concert hall?
I'm not going to tell you. Because every time I've done this piece, and I've done this piece a lot, I tell the orchestra at the first rehearsal, when we get to this point, usually somebody in the orchestra starts yay or applauding because they expect that to happen. And I say, I'm going to bet each and every one of you $5 that the audience will not applaud here. I've never lost this bet. What I'm not going to tell you is because it involves something visual. And to give it away spoils the fun. I even don't tell the orchestra what I'm going to do, and they don't see it until the first performance. And once I give that downbeat for the loud bit, you see the smiles on the orchestra break out. I'm not sure how the winds manage because they have to play. But it's always a fun moment for me because you're right, it's triumphant. But there's something amusing about this. It also tells us a lot about how Tchaikovsky probably thought about his audiences back all those years. They would have been aware that that chord is not the same as the key that you're supposed to arrive at. Mm. That chord's a B major chord. You're going to be arriving at E major, which is the signature key of the work. So the audience probably was sophisticated enough to realize this is the dominant. We're not supposed to applaud here. And yes, you don't want applause. There's a wonderful story of Zubin Mehta in Israel getting to this point. He gives the cutoff, and the audience starts applauding. He gets the orchestra up for a bow, goes off stage, comes back, comes out. They take a bow. He turns around, and they start the coda as if it was the encore. I'm not going to do that.
And with that, I want to be careful about not playing up too much this idea of the etiquette of when to applaud and not to applaud, because the movement now is really to not be focused
on that. Well, you don't want to applaud during a movement. But between, it actually doesn't bother me in most cases. Sometimes, yes. But for example, in the Sixth Symphony, the third movement is a march. And Tchaikovsky knew very well that the ending of that movement was going to provoke applause. There's no way to avoid it. No matter what you do with your arms, no matter how you try to do it, people are going to applaud there. And to me, the conductors who go headlong into the last one, which has no key relationship to the movement that came before, and you need to settle down. You need to have some time before you start this tragedy of the last one. Or say you're doing a Paganini violin concerto, the first one, a cadenza, 5 minutes long, and you want the audience to be up there screaming. So sometimes it's really okay to express yourself. We don't want to inhibit that. Just not during a movement.
So when a movement ends with a big flourish, it's okay to be a human being and indulge that,
absolutely,
that urge to applaud.
That's exactly right. Well, that's the end of the movement.
Yeah. Well, you talk about moving on. Have you listened to this? When's the last time you heard this recording?
I haven't heard it since we made it. That was the first, as we were playing those couple of excerpts, I'm going, is that really how I want to do it now? And wait a minute. Yeah, that retard, I think I still would do. That one, I'm not so sure it would make so much. That's why I don't go back and listen, because I'd like to keep it fresh. The same reason that when people come up to the podium and they try, can I see your score? Because what they're looking for is what I might have marked. Did I change the dynamic? Did I do this, do that? You'll find now in the standard repertoire, there's almost no markings of any kind. Why? Because I know the pieces really well, and I want to be fresh. I want to be looking at the music, not from what I did before, but what Tchaikovsky is telling me.
Do you still hear new things in a piece like that?
Every time. Great piece. That's why it's a great piece. How can you not? For instance, that chord we just talked about, the one that provokes the applause. Now, usually with that chord, which we call a seventh chord, it's usually four notes. In this case, it would be B, D sharp, F sharp, A. And that would give you the signal that those notes have to move to resolve into the E major. Well, Tchaikovsky leaves out the A. So it's actually understandable why people would applaud. If he'd have the A natural in there, prominent, it wouldn't have the same effect. They would know that this is going to go on. So he's playing with the audience just a little bit when he writes it.
Well, we do need to take a quick break, but we will be back shortly to continue this conversation with St. Louis Symphony Orchestra Conductor Laureate Leonard Slatkin. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Jeremy Goodwin, and we're talking about a few days of musical festivities celebrating the life and career of longtime St. Louis Symphony music director Leonard Slatkin. They include a concert program Friday morning and Sunday afternoon, a talk by Slatkin at the Clark Family Branch of St. Louis County Library Friday, and an open rehearsal with three up-and-coming conductors on Saturday. Here in the studio to continue the conversation is Leonard Slatkin, and joining us now is the composer Cindy McTee, whose work Timepiece will be part of the program at the Two Hill. Cindy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, and you two have met, I take it.
Yeah, about 10 minutes ago. It was a lovely woman.
But for folks who aren't into the inside baseball, how long have you been married?
Not long enough.
No.
What an answer.
That's great. Gold star, my husband. We've been married about 13 years, but we met in St. Louis in 1985 through music. I was here to experience a reading of my of a fledgling piece for orchestra that was chosen to be read by Leonard's composer in residence at the time, Joan Tower. And it was a forgettable piece, but I learned a lot.
Big moment, I guess, in retrospect.
It was huge.
Well, Cindy, your work, Timepiece, will be in the concert. It's about 8 minutes long. You wrote in your original program notes that it reflects your interest in the works of Carl Jung. How so?
Well, he was interested in a concept that we use in music quite a lot, the concept of resolving oppositions between high and low and fast and slow, of, let's say, balancing those more than resolving them, balancing them. And those kinds of ideas between opposing forces in music got me to thinking about how to shape it, not to forget about the fact that you can't really do one thing all of the time. For example, I like to bring older music into my pieces as well. In the case of Timepiece, that doesn't really happen. But that's one of the things I like to do. Even when I'm decorating a house, an antique of some sort in the context of a modern house always seems like a good idea.
You're not looking for a monochromatic effect.
Yeah, that's true. Lots of tension and opposition to create excitement.
Let's hear some of Cindy McTee's Timepiece as performed here by the North Texas Wind Ensemble. Cindy, you said you're influenced by the repetitive sounds of finely crafted machinery. Is the Timepiece an example of that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. When I was young, my grandfather would often try to fix his old watches and take them apart, and I loved the circular gears and interlocking kinds of things. And I was also very interested in the automobile as a something that was fun to drive, took me to places I could never go otherwise, and the machinery, the actual act of driving it was of interest to me. I always had a manual transmission car until I could no longer find one. So the sounds of a finely crafted machinery could be analogous to what happens in an orchestra on a kind of mechanical level, not on an artistic level, really, but everything in music has to work at that mechanical level as well. And so that's always been of interest to me, as well as what it expresses.
And you wrote this as a commission for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra in 2000 with the millennium in mind. Sometimes right. Those sorts of occasion pieces disappear quickly, but this has proven to be pretty popular, huh? People play this piece.
Well, yes, it's been played, and it wasn't just about the turn of the millennium, but it was also to celebrate the Dallas Symphony's 100th anniversary. It was really an expression of the voice that I had been developing over several years. So maybe that's why it's endured.
It's always nice when you look at something you did 25 years ago and you still like it.
Yes, that's a pleasure for me, for sure.
Leonard, you've conducted this many times. Mm-hmm. At the Hollywood Bowl last year. You're taking it to the Kennedy Center next month. What do you hear in that piece that brings you back to it?
I hear a lot of Cindy's other voices from other pieces, as she mentioned. Having recorded several, I think now, having conducted pretty much all the orchestral works that she wrote, I love the idea that there's a style that goes from one piece to the next, how each piece emerges from the one that came before. There are some experimental works that Cindy did a little bit earlier. Einstein's Dream comes to mind. But for the most part, it's this rhythmic energy that dominates. It's a little bit reflective of a contemporary jazz scene to it, in the sonorities and the way the rhythms go in various syncopations. It's a lot of fun to conduct, and it's a lot of fun to play. I think players enjoy it very much. I just did it in Lyon as well, and they just really enjoyed doing it. It was fun for them. When you get a French orchestra, that's fun. You've accomplished a lot.
Well, Cindy, the Washington Post critic Robert Batty called one of your pieces, a different piece, unmistakably American. Do you agree with that?
I think so. Leonard mentioned the influence of jazz, which, of course, is very American, and I grew up playing jazz, listening to it. It was the first music I really knew because my parents were dance hall musicians, and they played a lot of music from the American song, Great American Songbook. Maybe not so much in a jazz style, but I did follow up all of that with listening to the great jazz artists play those pieces as well. So that was really in my ear from a very early age. In addition to that, the energy that these pieces express seems to suggest a kind of modern American city, urban environment to me. So I suppose those things would be the most American about them.
And I know Leonard has investigated this question as well, but what does American music sound like?
Actually, Virgil Thomson told us exactly what it is when he was approached by somebody and said, what does it take to write American music? He says, you have to be an American and write music.
Yeah.
That's exactly it.
Well, you've once said that that orchestras should be playing Aaron Copland's Third Symphony as much as they play Beethoven's Fifth.
Yeah,
is that because it's as good?
Yes, that would be one way to put it, but also that it's, as are several other pieces, representing a high point in the cultural experience of this country. Right now, there's a lot of emphasis, and rightly so, on new compositions. We always like that because we don't know what it's going to turn out to be. But the problem is we tend then to neglect the masterworks of the past. So Copland III heads a long list of American symphonists, including William Schumann, Peter Menon, Howard Hanson, David Diamond, Roger Sessions, on and on and on. And these composers have pretty much disappeared, and yet they shaped the whole landscape, which make pieces by Cindy possible, and the composers of today, a Jesse Montgomery, for instance. They're shaped by those voices that came 100 years before they did. And we need to hear that in order to understand where we are now.
And something you both share, Cindy and Leonard, is an interest in the music education piece of all this. And I'm thinking about a celebration of your work. The program this weekend is occasioned by your 80th birthday, but it's not exactly nostalgic. Right? It includes three pieces that are new to the orchestra, the one old favorite from Tchaikovsky. Tell me, why does it not make sense for a celebration of Leonard Slatkin to be filled with greatest hits from the repertory?
Because I didn't want it. I knew exactly what I wanted for this year. It wasn't about just me. Could have been, but I didn't want that. I wanted to celebrate the heritage of the Slatkins and the Allers on my mother's side. I wanted to celebrate Cindy and make it very clear that my existence as a musician is formed by those people who are around me. It's also why, for the most part this season, I'm seeing orchestras that I've known most of my life in some way or other, whether it's Detroit, Washington, New York Philharmonic, Lyon, Canaria, places like this. It's really to have a good time in the 80th year, surrounded by good friends and great music.
And this open rehearsal Saturday with three other conductors, what should folks expect there?
It's the idea of understanding what a conductor does. The three that are coming are very gifted. I've seen them all. I know how they work. They are ready to really begin full-time, big-time professional careers. What we're going to do is watch them in rehearsal, and I will stop them when I see something that should be fixed on a technical level, and the orchestra will do the same. I will maybe say, stop. Clarinets, what did the conductor do here that caused you to miss that entrance? Or what didn't the conductor do? So that the conductors get an immediate feedback from professionals. Remember, the members of the St. Louis Symphony on this occasion will have played the music many more times than the conductors have led it. So they're going to be speaking from experience. The conductors will be meeting with members of the staff to understand what is PR, what is marketing, what is development, what does the executive director do. By the time they finish the entire week, not just that one rehearsal, they'll have a very good picture of what it's like to be a conductor of a major American orchestra, from rehearsal through watching the performances we give, through understanding how the whole team is put together.
Cindy, you also spent years as a music educator. Mm-hmm. What do you get from that experience of working with younger musicians?
Well, in trying to help them, I have to sort of take a look at myself and try to figure out how best to convey to them the essence of what I think their piece is saying. And so the conversation is so important. They teach me much more than I do through that conversation of trying to decipher and figure out a way to express what they're asking for in terms of education. You know, it's music is a very abstract art form, and so trying to convey thoughts into words, to translate music into words, is not an easy thing. And so I learned an enormous amount from the attempt to dig into what they were doing. I could then more easily dig into what I was doing.
And you learned from them too?
Oh, absolutely. They kept me current. First time a student walked into my office speaking a language I didn't understand, having to do with computers and music, I thought, you know what, I have to get on board with this, or I'm really... It inspired me to learn. And
you incorporated electronic sounds into your work.
Well, I embraced the computer right away. I knew I had to, and then it became a tool as valuable to me as the pencil and paper. And there are all kinds of issues about that. You know, the computer is a machine, and you have to make sure you don't let it do anything more than serve your needs. Don't let it control you. And that's been an issue over the years, I think. We let the computer sort of take over sometimes when we shouldn't.
Hmm. Use it as a tool rather than
And it's a very
crutch.
It's a wonderful tool. But I think the human involvement is still really very, very, very important. That goes without saying, of course, but it's not easy to keep it at some distance, especially now.
Leonard, whether it's the youth orchestra or the more than 200 new pieces that you premiered, your career has been about the future of music. Where do you see the future of American music right now? Is it in a healthy state?
It's certainly more varietous than it's ever been. When I started in 68, who would have thought that music for video games would be a big deal? And now it's something that so many composers are going into. The nature of writing for films has changed. There was no Hans Zimmer back then. There was no formulaic way to do these big blockbusters. You did it the old-fashioned way. Now that exists. The language and palette of other cultures who've come to settle in the United States has made a big impact, whether they come from within our own country or they come from, say, Asia. We didn't have the influence of Chinese music on our own American sensibility back in the 60s. This all came later. So I think the future is actually quite bright because we're about change and it's moving forward. Where it winds up, I don't know, but we got to keep trying.
The St. Louis Symphony Orchestra will perform Slatkin's Legacy, a birthday celebration concert at the Two Hill Performing Arts Center, that's on UMTL's campus, Friday morning at 10:30 and again Sunday at 3. You can tune in to St. Louis Public Radio Saturday night at 7:30 to hear a broadcast of tomorrow's concert. Leonard Slatkin and Cindy McTee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for the music.
This episode was produced by Jeremy Goodwin.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.